From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. I'm here tonight with Lil.
Hey.
Phil's kicking around here somewhere. I think, what do you have to do? Go take care of Sydney?
Yeah, he probably went to get some snacks or something, huh?
Righto.
Yeah.
And we will be your hosts for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 37 of Little Brother for the 9th of March 2002. Stay tuned hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 37 of Little Brother for the 9th of March 2002. Stay tuned, Little Brother's right around the corner. Okay, so let's get started. As usual, we need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. And responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal.
What about irresponsible parties?
Can you hear me at all?
Oh, I can hear you perfectly well.
Okay, sounds weird in my head.
Your headphones must be wonky.
Yeah, I think that they're doing that.
Yeah.
At any rate, if you would like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. The number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. Phil has just joined us. Are you there? I can't hear you. Okay, there's something going wrong with Phil's mic. So,
it's gone wonky.
Yes, it's really gone wonky. And that one's out, too. Isn't this fun? Don't you just love high technology? Okay, we'll have to sort this one out. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Let's give this thing another try here. And Phil is here. Has just joined us. Say hi, Phil.
He's busy choking on his
snacks. Phil chokes on his air, so well, I guess we'll come back to him. He's with us. Take our word for it. I think he's okay. So, as usual, we'll start with items from the Risks Digest. Let's see here. There was an article reported by the BBC. It says, it was a perfect day in the capital for viewing the skyline from the giant London Eye, but a computer problem made the 450-foot-high structure rotate too fast, and it was halted amid safety concerns. Engineers have been brought in to get the attraction, officially known as the British Airways London Eye, up and running again. This calls to mind Ben Moffat's narrative some weeks ago about a carnival ride which gave him a bad moment by displaying a blue screen of death just before it began its planned rapid descent. The difference is that in his case, the computer was merely providing some graphical effects and was not apparently responsible for actually controlling the ride. Not so in this case.
Wow, I saw the London Eye. I didn't go on it.
The London Eye.
They must have been disembarking people pretty quickly because they, you know, it just goes a little ways and stops to let people on and off. So
the London Eye was spinning so fast, people were sticking to the walls.
You know, the only way to really make the London Eye seem like it's worth riding is to make it go faster. It seems to me, but.
Well,
I know it's high and all, but
seen
it's quite tame.
Itself. I've seen photos of it, so I know basically
it's very different
what
in
it
person.
Looks like. But
you're surprised when you get there at how incredibly slow it goes.
Yeah, the best part about it was the ice cream vendor outside.
Yeah.
But like I say, I've seen what it looks like, and it's just. I guess the main point is just that you get a good view of the surroundings.
Right.
Yeah.
You do.
So,
but I don't know. It's not exciting. You'd think it'd be exciting. It's not.
Well,
it's just crowded. That's all it is.
It's exciting if the concept of seeing London from high overhead is exciting to you. It's exciting if you're afraid of heights.
No, I mean, I'm afraid of heights, and I wasn't afraid of it.
Oh, okay, never mind.
I mean, like, I mean, it moves that slow. It's not scary at all.
Peter Trey is reporting that a man used CityLink more than 220 times. This is a highway in Australia, attracting at least $22,000 in fines because he didn't know it had become a toll road, the Melbourne Magistrates Court was told yesterday. Some highways in Australia cannot be legally used without a radio tag. This poor soul hadn't updated his address with the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the risk lies in building systems which automatically rack up charges without limit and no backup notification system. A big flashing sign saying E-tag missing really might have helped in this situation. Okay, I have an objection here. I have a big objection here. If they have the ability to track you down if you are missing, why did you do that?
Because Sydney's thirsty.
Okay. If you... Oh, man, I lost my train of thought.
If you can track people down...
If you can track people down to tell them that they didn't have an E-tag, what the hell do you need the E-tag for in the first place?
Well, that's just picture. Like the labor-intensive tracking down instead of just, oh, whoop, there he is. Look at that.
Well, why don't they just... Well, this, they've been doing it with speed radar in Australia for some time now. They focus in on the license plate. They feed the license plate to an OCR system. The OCR checks out who it is, compares the description of the vehicle with the actual appearance of the vehicle, and if it's a match on color, they say, okay, that's the guy.
Well, sure, that tells you that that's the guy, but that doesn't tell you where the guy lives.
I don't know.
What the problem was here. He didn't tell people he had moved.
That's true.
It caused some kind of crotchety wonkiness in the system. I like the word wonky today.
I've been noticing that, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm getting ready. I'm going home. I'm watching Brit TV tonight, so I'm thinking wonky.
Okay. Speaking of Brit TV, the BBC had a project in 1986 called the Domesday Project. Was a time capsule containing sound, images, video, and data defining life in Britain in 1986, and it's now unreadable. The data was stored on 12-inch video discs that were only readable by a BBC-manufactured microcomputer, of which only a handful still exist. The time capsule contains 250,000 place names, 25,000 maps, 50,000 pictures, 3,000 data sets, and 60 minutes of moving pictures. The article notes that the original Domesday Book, compiled in 1086 for tax purposes, is still in mint condition. A few additional comments given by Chris Leeson were, the BBC microcomputer, along with the original Sinclair computers, was the computer that sparked off the computer revolution in the UK. The BBC micro was especially popular in schools, whereas the Sinclair computers were more popular in the home. To be fair, the 1986 Domesday Project was in the days before the really rapid changes in technology came into force, and the BBC Micro was probably not a bad choice of platform then, especially when you consider that there were very few other choices available. 50,000 pictures alone take up a lot of space. Now, the moral and the risk is that if you're wanting long-term data storage, the format is just as important as the materials.
Two words, hard copy.
This is not a new problem.
Three more words, acid-free paper.
It has appeared in the Risks Digest in the past, but it's worth keeping in mind. And he comments that he still has some old Commodore 64 discs with some very old account details on it. Not that he's got a Commodore 64 on which to read it. Permanent records, however, he says, are all printouts.
Hard copy.
Yeah, speaking of the Timex Sinclair, even if you had one that's still working, the keyboard was just this cheap Mylar membrane material. And over time, it cracks. It becomes very brittle. So good luck finding a Timex Sinclair that still has the keyboard functioning.
You know, in actuality, it was probably a very good choice to use something with a real keyboard on it. for this particular project, given that the alternative major computer of the time was the Timex Sinclair, and it did have that stupid membrane keyboard on it, and I can't imagine doing any degree of mass data entry on a keyboard such as this. Why does Sydney have her hand up? Does she want to talk?
I love Will.
Thank you, honey.
Okay. So, by the way, for those who are not acquainted, Sydney is Phil's. How old is she now? Five.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, is Phil's 5 year old daughter, and she comes with us every now and then to join us and stick her tongue out as she's doing right now.
She loves the radio. She loves being here, but she doesn't really say much.
It's the weirdest thing.
She's intimidated to talk.
She doesn't want to talk.
But she
doesn't have anything to do, but she just loves to be here.
Hmm. Anyway, Dan Jacobson had submitted to the Risks Digest. He says, now that I have traded my corporate life for back to nature, every once in a while there's a long-term bond for my past life or something that is about to expire. Hence, I must log on to some corporate website wherein, right off the bat, I get a message advising that I need a browser upgrade. Thank you for visiting Jackson National Life Insurance Company's website. We've noticed you're using an earlier version of Insert Browser here. Also, aren't those little lock symbols supposed to lock when you're asked for social security number, password, etc.? And don't you hate those websites that after filling in a long form, you're to pick off which of the 50 states you live in? He says, I get stuck here. I would have used the toll-free number, but it's not toll-free for me. Okay, now turning to the AT&T Universal Card site. Ah, AT&T, Equal Opportunity Employer. Okay, but still can't use the Lynx browser. Now, what if I was vision impaired? And why, after establishing that I am not spam, can I not have an email conversation with the corporate giants about compatibility issues with their websites without having to log in to send or receive secure email? It takes half of my modem session. This was sent, as I said, by Dan Jacobson, who is writing from Taiwan. Oh, I see they've left the CD player in repeat again. You want to snap? Have you got one there that looks interesting?
Yeah, I actually don't know what this one's about, but it shows a picture of a funny-looking fella here,
about.
And
yeah,
the title is "The Customer's Always Wrong," and I don't know. I'm kind of a fan of an attitude like that. So it says, "Music and film moguls and a few senators think fans are thieves and want to cripple technology to stop you from making copies." Copywriting CD technology. There was something decidedly Enron-esque about the hearing last week before the Senate Commerce Committee. No potential illegalities, mind you, but you had Disney CEO Michael Eisner and News Corp President Peter Chernin speaking on behalf of record labels and movie studios to lobby Congress for laws to prop up their beleaguered business model as they cope with the internet. What, Sid?
I love it here!
Yep, she definitely loves being in the radio.
Yeah, she definitely needs the mic level turned slightly...
Yeah, just a tidge down.
Which one's she at? Blue?
Yeah. There's a...
Okay.
Yeah,
sure. What do you mean?
There you go.
There we go. Perfect. That's a better volume. There you go. Okay. As with a certain Houston energy company's dealings with friendly government officials, one couldn't help but wonder where the little people stood in all of this. The answer came from Senator Fritz Hollings, clearly a friend of content holders. When Congress sits idly by in the face of these file-sharing activities, we essentially sanction the internet as a haven for thievery, said committee chairman.
Arr,
matey, arr, thievery. Charging over 10 million people with stealing. That's where citizens stand, not as potential consumers, but as candidates for prison denim. Mm. This tracks with the mentality of the record labels and film studios these days. Despite a plethora of problems that have nothing to do with the net, media executives are obsessed with the idea that their customers are shiftless pirates, who want their wares for free. The world got a chance to sample this mindset at the Grammys last week when National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences head Michael Green hijacked his own award ceremony to rant queegishly about music downloading, the most insidious virus in our midst. So much for HIV. In the short run, the media company. So that was actually written in the article. That's not my, I can't take credit for that.
Yeah, who's, I forgot who wrote this article. You should probably credit him.
It says Steve Levy, Levy. Stephen Levy.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah. In the short run, the media companies are counting on the courts to shut down the Napsters of the world. Long range, they're betting on security schemes that intentionally limit the functions of both hard and software. Some labels have already begun to ship compact discs encoded with a special process that prevents copying. Consumer advocates are appalled that the copy-protected discs deny users their legal rights to copy music for personal use on digital devices like computers and MP3 players. To make sure that the customer's larcenous options are totally closed off, however, copy protection must be built into computers and other devices. Andrew Hollings's proposed Security Standards and Certification Act. The bill demands that all digital electronic devices be saddled with systems that restrict copying of tunes and movies. Earth to moguls. Beware of what you wish for. Business school professors could feast for years on the unintended consequences that come from treating Britney Spears tunes like nuclear secrets. Clearly, clamping locks on electronic equipment and intentionally crippling CDs wouldn't increase sales. Would it depress sales? Almost certainly. Millions of people commonly and legally buy CDs, rip the tunes on computer hard drives, and then either download to MP3 players or mix and burn their own CD compilations. But if new discs are copy protected, someone who wants a classic James Taylor album might do better to buy a vintage disc on eBay. MP3 fans desiring a rip-friendly disc of Moby's latest would be forced to seek a pirated version where someone has illegally broken the security controls. I can't see how this situation would boost album revenues. Then there's the impact on the electronics industry. If new computers, CD-DVD players, and personal video recorders are hobbled, consumers will hold on to their pre-Hollings machines. As Intel's Leslie Vadaz warned the Commerce Committee, your legislation will substantially retard innovation and will reduce the usefulness of our products to consumers. What makes this all totally insane is that internet file sharing is not necessarily the foe of copyright holders. True, the ease of making and distributing digital files will always present a challenge for the labels and studios, but it's also a potential gold mine, an instant, ultra-low-cost delivery system, and a targeted marketing vehicle. No outlaw service can ever provide consumers with the deep libraries at guaranteed high quality that content owners can deliver. And if media companies adopted a perfectly feasible system of digital rights management that allowed music fans to make a few copies for personal use, most people wouldn't bother to do the pirate thing. If the prospect is scary, the media giants can take comfort in history. Their original reaction to previous technological advances, from talkies to television to the VCR, was just as hysterical as it is with the internet. The Disney Corp was once celebrated for its crowd-pleasing recipe, under-promise and over-deliver. But Eisner and his copyright-holding counterparts, drinking deep from the fountain of fear, seem to have adopted a new motto, overcharge and disable. Things won't get better for them until they realize that even for copyright holders, the internet can be a magic kingdom.
Wow.
Wow.
That says quite a lot there. Now, I did actually have a transcript of what's-his-face's speech here. Let me see, what was his name here? Michael Green, the Recording Academy president.
The whining fella at the Grammys.
Yes, that's the one. And he had actually the New York Times ran an interesting thing about his speech here. I'm going to skip over the preliminaries because you pretty much covered them in the Michael Levy or Stephen Levy article you just read there. But I'm going to skip to the good part here. It says one of the downloaders for hire at about $12 an hour, Namer Faraz, has stepped forward to say that Mr. Green's claim that three students downloaded 6,000 files from easily accessible websites isn't even true. For starters, Mr. Faraz, 17, isn't a student. He left school to start his own technology business. But more to the point, he says that the group did not spend 2 days downloading music. They spent three. And most revealing, he says that most of the music wasn't even downloaded from publicly accessible websites. Speaking about Mr. Green, he said it would take 2 days to do all the stuff, and we did it for 3 days from 9 to 6 and left the computers on all night, except we'd come back and the computers would be frozen. obviously they're running a Microsoft operating system.
Clearly.
Yeah, it's rather obvious. I was the only one who used BearShare and Kazaa extensively, he said, referring to two popular file exchanging programs, and half my files never completed. They were halfway downloaded or not downloaded at all. As for the two others, both students at the University of California, Los Angeles, he said they hardly even used file sharing sites. Instead, he said they used AOL Instant Messenger to receive songs which friends had sent them from their hard drives. That not only means the songs weren't on public websites, but also that there is no guarantee they were ever illegally downloaded, since some of them could have been from CDs purchased by students and ripped onto their hard drives. Mr. Faraz estimates that 4,000 of the songs were sent as private messages using Instant Messenger, and a few songs were legitimate authorized downloads from the website mp3.com. Guess what? It's not illegal to share the content that you've downloaded from mp3.com or iuma.com, as far as I know. These sites readily make this content available, and I am certain that as long as they don't pull a particular recording from their site, you can redistribute it all you want. And I'm sure that actually the sites will thank you for the favor, because the fact that you've just reduced their bandwidth demand. Does that not make sense?
Wasn't mp3.com involved in some kind of lawsuit a while back? Or I remember some kind of story, but I can't remember the particulars of it.
Oh, yeah. They had a system set up where if you proved to them that you owned a CD, they would let you have access to ripped content from that CD. Basically, they had pre-ripped it. And the record companies got their knickers in a knot over that, too.
Which is ridiculous. But
absolutely.
Well, how exactly do you prove that you own it, though?
Like UPC
you
or
drop
something?
The CD in the, you drop the CD into your CD-ROM drive.
Does that really save you all that much time ripping it?
Yes.
Having it pre-ripped on the website saves you the time?
Yeah.
Unless you have a 28.8 modem or something.
Well, you see, the thing of it is, once you've proven that you own it, then that proof of ownership becomes attached to your login on mp3.com.
Mm.
Or at least this is my understanding of it. I never actually used the service myself. Mm. Anytime I've used mp3.com, it's usually been for the freebies, because the freebies, usually you get a... you get a bunch of junk in the freebies, but eventually you'll find something that the record companies have chosen not to promote for one reason or another, and quite frequently it's actually pretty good.
And quite frequently a lot better than what the record companies have decided to promote, I'm sure.
Yeah, although that's not always the case either. I did actually pick up one track off of mp3.com from the Clay People that was later released. Was later taken on by the major record companies. I was really surprised to actually hear it on the radio one day, because of the fact that I thought it was not in distribution. No.
But, well, there you are.
Yeah, exactly. So it's serving its intended purpose. It's getting some exposure for the artists that need it. Oh, let's see here. Let's see here. We got an item from Wired News here. This is titled House Reps Rap, Unshackle the CD.
Oh, yeah. This is one of about a bazillion articles about Congress you have there, I noticed.
Oh, yeah. Music CDs equipped with copy protection will, if Rick Boucher gets his wish, soon be as obsolete as 8-track cassettes. Okay, stop right there. It's not an 8-track cassette. I know this is nitpicking. It's an 8-track cartridge. A cassette is the littler thing that's got 4 tracks on it. Anyway, the feisty Democratic congressman from Virginia says he plans to introduce legislation banning or at least regulating compact discs outfitted with anti-copying technology. Few discs sold in America currently feature the controversial scheme, but the recording industry expects that as worries over digital piracy grow, the technique will become widespread. Suffice to say, there probably will be a legislative response to ensure that consumer rights will be protected, said Boucher in an interview.
Now, what are the... do you know anything about the copy protection involved? Do they purposely write bad sectors?
That's it, exactly. But it doesn't matter what the technique is that they're utilizing. The bottom line of it is that they're actually blocking a number of legitimate users from having access to this material. If you have a anything other than an absolutely rock-stupid CD player that you're trying to play the CD on, it's not going to run. If you try to play it on a DVD player, it won't run. You try to play it on an MP3-enabled CD player,
it won't
run.
You try to sit at your desk and listen to
it on
your computer.
It won't run, you know?
Yeah, but if you're trying to duplicate the whole CD itself, there are programs out there that'll do just like a raw copy, errors and all.
Hey, we never did our Fast and Furious Bifest, remember?
Yeah, you know,
that was one of the first discs that was released, and we were going to go out, buy them, check them on our computer, realize that they couldn't play, bring them back all unwrapped and say, hey, I can't play this on my computer, and all they can do is exchange it for another one.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, if you make it.
Although it since came out, since that came out, Universal has said that they will accept back for a refund copies of that CD. So
well, that changes the whole thing.
Yeah, it makes it not particularly a useful action. Well, the thing of it is that they'd been trawling the web. You know, it's not an idea that that had just come out of nowhere. You know? It's something that people have been planning to do for some time. Well, we're up to the point now where we actually have to take our break. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to let you know that Little Brother will be back in a couple of minutes, and that you are listening to 91.5 FM
WRPI
Troy.
WRPI.
And the show is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. Phil, Lil, and Sydney are here tonight. And the topic is technology. Your phone calls are welcome, 518-276-6248. And before I go on to do After Dark, I'm going to just quickly say that, yeah, I realize classic rock is not usually what's in the lineup for this particular radio station, and certainly not for this show. However, that particular track from Floyd just seemed so damned appropriate, since we're in the process of picking on the record companies. And that track seems to do it quite well. Okay, that said, I've got a couple items here from the Capital District, things that are going on in... it looks like some of this stuff is over in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, but that's really just a hop, skip, and a jump away from here, if you don't mind a little bit of driving. And we start with Club Helsinki in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, 284 Main Street. On March 21st at 8:30, they have Marcus James, who is a African roots songwriter. And says a San Francisco-based musician. He has a long-standing appreciation for African music, especially for the unique sound signatures of Mali. As a result, his roots-based original songs are infused with the sounds and feel of some of Africa's richest musical traditions. On March 14th, for a second there I thought it said February 21st, but that's the date this was printed out, so that's okay. On March 14th, New York City-based modern lounge group Dave's True Story will be playing at Club Helsinki, same location, 284 Main Street, Great Barrington. Best described as jazz lounge with pop overtones. So if that interests you, that's out there. And let's see, Jeff Muladar, also a roots music guitarist. Music guitarist, like there's any other kind of guitarist. Roots music star Jeff Muladar will be playing at Helsinki on March 28th, show starting at 9 o'clock. Widely considered one of the great voices and musical forces to emerge from the folk blues and folk rock scenes centered in Cambridge and Woodstock in the 60s.
Well, maybe we should consider the guitar outside of the musical genre. Maybe we could come up with a new art form.
Well, now, if you want to go in that particular route, there are some art forms which are arguably music, but arguably at the same time not music, but nonetheless worthy of investigation. Say, for example, some of the works of Negative Land.
Well, it does sometimes involve guitars.
It does, but at other times it does not.
Perhaps we could do performance art involving guitars.
I'm sure such a thing is possible.
I'm sure such a thing's been done. Here is a modern dance about the guitar.
Hey, there you go.
Interpretive dance.
Modern interpretive dance about the guitar and with guitars.
Is there anything in the world worse than interpretive dance? And let me just apologize now to all the interpretive dancers out there. That's just the opinion of me, myself, and I, and has nothing to do with WRPI, who in fact loves interpretive dance.
Okay, I guess we can move on now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, since you are doing After Dark sort of datey things to do after dated things, I mean. Next Friday and Saturday, if there's any Schenectadians out there listening, there's been a new group form called the Coalition for a Livable City, trying to clean up like Hamilton Hill and Vail and some of the worst neighborhoods of Schenectady. And next weekend we are doing a walkthrough in part of Hamilton Hill from 6 to midnight on both Friday and Saturday. We're going to be meeting at Carlton at Emmett, and more I don't really know. Personally, I'm going to bring snacks, but I don't know about anything else. Any other details, we're going to be there, we're going to be walking, and that's it.
You know what would be really funny?
Yes.
If, like, all the people who are in this coalition to help improve Schenectady are the ones getting stopped and harassed by the police?
They probably are. Actually, you know, Claudia used to have a friend of mine, Claudia used to have relatives out in Schenectady, and they lived in Hamilton Hill. And, you know, the drug dealers can be right in front of the police officers, but the police officers will harass, you know, the house full of innocent people. And it happens all the time.
It seems to me like it's really a question of training. They just don't know what to look for.
They see black, and I don't know. I shouldn't make such allegations, but that's the conclusion I draw.
Well, I would just remind listeners that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly
are mine.
Strictly are those mine. Of the participants, and not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the RPI staff, WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union, and that responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. I just thought I would throw that out there because it seems appropriate at this moment.
Because I'm feeling particularly opinionated right now.
That's a pretty hefty bomb to drop there, dear. Okay. Anyhow, I guess with that aside, we could move back to... do you want to pick on the record companies some more?
Sure, we could pick out... Yeah, we can be done with the Schenectady police. Let's pick on the...
Okay.
The record companies are something more universal for all the listeners, not just those.
Okay, let's consider an idea that's been proposed in Congress here. The idea being that there's a bill that's been drafted, and of course it was by the senator from Disney himself, Fritz Hollings. By the way, he's in reality a South Carolina Democrat. So if you're from South Carolina, you may want to jump on this guy's case. I know there are some students in this area who may or may not be from South Carolina, and I also know that this radio show does go out over the internet, so you may be hearing it in South Carolina. So you might want to step up to the plate and have a word with this fellow, or at least have a word with his secretary, which is probably about as far as you'll really get. But the idea that he is proposing is legislation called the Security System Standards and Certification Act, or SSSCA, a version that was obtained by Wired News prohibits creating, selling, or distributing any interactive digital device that does not include and utilize certified security technologies. And when I did a little bit more digging into this idea, basically what it appears to me to be is that it is necessary for any piece of hardware or software that touches copyrighted content to be able to stop the user from doing that which they the copyright holder does not wish to have done. And the copyright holder has some pretty broad abilities to define what the end user can and cannot do. Now, I have a quick comment that I wanted to throw out about this, and that is that I'm going to steal a slogan from the pro-choice lobby here and say keep your laws off my computer. The problem that we are looking at here is that I can only think of three ways that one might implement a system that would seriously limit the ability of an end user to be able to do whatever they felt with the content once it was on their computer system. Method number one is to outlaw any system that does not. And that's right off the bat sounds like what they're going to do, or could be modified so that it can't. This potential possibility irritates the hell out of me. Because,
can you say that on the air?
Yes, you can. Because my operating system of choice has absolutely no chance of being certified simply because of the fact that it's open source, meaning if somebody was to come in here and put a copyright lock into it, all somebody's got to do is look at the source code, find the copyright lock, edit it out, recompile it, and wham, you're on the net again with a system that does not have the copyright lock on it. Option number two would be to set it up so that your hard drive is intelligent enough to look for this kind of content. Well, there's two ways you could do this. One is to have the file system implemented on the hard drive. This is not really practical because of the fact that different operating systems have got different requirements as far as what a file system capabilities are. Or the third is to have the hard drive kind of sit there and just know how every operating system works. And that is a gargantuan task and also very nearly impossible. What are your thoughts on this, Phil?
I think everyone should go Linux.
I don't know. I like the idea. I'll tell you one thing. Should this thing be signed into law? And should it have the net result of outlawing Linux? I hereby announce to the world that I will be engaging in an act of civil disobedience. I will not cease the use of Linux. It's as simple as that.
For a second, I thought you were going to announce your retirement from the NFL or something. That's what I look like. I hereby announce.
Yeah, right.
I will throw a temper tantrum if they outlaw Linux.
No, actually, I will not throw a temper tantrum.
I will
just simply ignore them. Speaking of Linux, and an item here out of off of MSNBC. This is called The Threat of a Linux Generation. Yeah, dangerous thought, isn't it? Microsoft free world. What a thought. Even computer programmers can sometimes let their emotions get the better of them. Could I be accused of that? Yes, I guess I could, couldn't I?
Well, you did just retire from the NFL. I don't know.
If I made a great product and Microsoft offered me a lot of money, I would spit in their faces, said Brett Slatkin, a student at Columbia University in New York.
Well, now that's just silliness. He could retire with that money.
His colleagues roll their eyes and accuse him of being stuck at the hippie stage, but then, when talks turn to the serious business of programming, they're of one pragmatic mind. One of the burning issues in the computer circles is whether the servers, the fastest-growing segment of the computer business, are going to run Microsoft software or an alternative, Linux, in the future. Microsoft's selling point has been its universe of tightly designed software that fits together like a puzzle, from the basic operating systems that make each computer run to software that controls networks to programs designed for specific tasks. But lately, Microsoft has been placing more and more restrictions on how the software can be used. That bothers programmers who crave the freedom to use the tools of their trade as they see fit. Nobody, by contrast, owns Linux. It's open source. As distinct from Microsoft's closed source software, this means that programmers have more leeway in how they handle any problems that might come up, particularly those that pertain to security. For this reason, Linux is winning favor among younger computer operators and programmers who and about to enter the job market, whose preferences may prove decisive in coming years. Linux has recently been making headway in the marketplace. A few years ago, computer firms IBM, Dell, Compaq, and others threw their support behind Linux, offering to accommodate it in their product lineups and support for their customers. Companies were initially slow to make the leap, But in the past year, some big firms attracted in part by the prospect of saving money on license fees to Microsoft have switched. Last October, Amazon.com said it saved $17 million in one quarter, thanks in part to Linux. And in February, online broker E-Trade took the plunge, and computer maker Sun Microsystems bowed to marketplace pressure and said that it would offer Linux on some of its computers. I think everybody's going to use it, says Dr. Robinson, a programmer at Salomon Smith Barney, who adopted Linux a year and a half ago. Linux now accounts for 27% of the server market worldwide, compared to Microsoft's 42% share, says research firm IDC. In Germany, Linux is already becoming something of a movement. Whereas American corporations moved from mainframes to networks of personal computer servers back in the 1980s, Europe lagged by a decade. By then, Linux had developed into a robust competitor to Windows, and European firms embraced Linux, and the internet boom provided further impetus. Siemens, Deutsche Bank, and Volkswagen have all been using Linux for years, and by last year, says IDC, 40% of the German corporations were doing so as well. Last week, the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, decided to switch its servers from Linux to Windows. My wish would be to declare the entire Bundestag a Microsoft-free zone, said Jörg Taus, a deputy for the Social Democrats. It would be irresponsible, he said, to entrust the work of parliament to the closed-source software. Computer programmers are quick to point out that they don't impugn the quality of Microsoft software. No, not true. I impugn the quality of Microsoft software, but we'll leave it at that.
But some are more cautious.
Okay, fair enough. It has some advantages. I will grant this point. It's generally more consistent in quality and easier to install on servers, especially for inexperienced programmers. Rather, the issue is more of who controls the software. If a security loophole, say, is found in a corporate computer network that uses Linux, the firm's own programmers can fix it themselves. Microsoft keeps details of its own software so close to its vest that Windows is opaque to programmers, and they have to rely on Microsoft technicians to make repairs. What really has programmers worried are Microsoft's recent steps to prevent piracy. The firm's new product activation policy, rolled out in October with the release of its XP operating system, requires customers to register Office XP, Windows XP, Project 2002, and other products with the firm's headquarters in Redmond, Washington. Moving the software to a new computer or making significant programming changes requires re-registering it. And how's this for intrusive? From time to time, the software checks your computer's ID to make sure it matches the registration. You might wake up one day to find that your computer's gone into reduced functionality mode. It won't save or create new documents. Greg Sullivan, product manager for Windows XP, says that the product activation policy was designed to be as unobtrusive as possible and will have negligible effects on anybody who isn't breaking the law. Yannick Parekh, 24, a Columbia graduate student, is not reassured. What worries him and many of his colleagues is that Microsoft will continue to tighten the screws, perhaps going so far as to offer Windows and other software as services rather than products. In the past, the product was in a box, and you could take it out and put it in your machine. If you wanted, you could take the software off the machine and sell it to a friend. Now Microsoft is taking things to the next degree. Microsoft Sullivan wouldn't say that whether the company plans to offer software as services over the internet. The whole industry has talked broadly about the idea, he says. For now, Microsoft's Windows rules the home. Most consumers merely want their computers to work and have no appetite for the tedious process of installing Linux. That may change. Linux hackers from Germany and elsewhere are working on a new version of a Windows-like graphical interface for Linux PCs called KDE. They expect to release that this spring, free of charge. Microsoft is not taking the threat lying down. It now allows some of its larger corporate customers to tinker with Windows software. In Berlin, a Microsoft hired a German lobbying firm to sway the Bundestag. In the end, Microsoft persuaded the parliament to continue using Windows NE for 5,000 new PCs, but the servers are already in the hands of the enemy. Windows NE? NE?
Well, I know they had, Windows 98 NL is the Netherlands version.
Okay.
Which is, it's basically all in Dutch.
I don't remember what NE is, though. I've heard that before, but I don't remember.
But it might be another version in a different language, but it's pretty much the same operating system, just all in different languages.
Okay. I know NT stands for New Technology, and I'm wondering if...
it's probably something equally...
If NE is the equivalent concept expressed in German.
I don't know. But I know Windows 98 NL, that was the Netherlands version of it. And it's quite interesting seeing it all in Dutch.
I remember trying to find my way around my mother-in-law's computer when Phil switched it to Dutch. It was quite a chore.
Now, why did you do that?
Kicks.
Yeah, just for fun.
Okay.
You know, just to see, you know.
Same reason I hung her bra up from the light. It's entertaining to watch her get frustrated.
Okay. I suppose you got a point there.
Yeah, but see, in the end, it actually ended up I was more frustrated because I happened to be there and wanted to use the computer and couldn't figure out anything on it at all.
So it backfired.
Yeah, it's not really anything like English. At least I couldn't recognize any words. Not like if you're using something like German or French, you can at least sort of make out some roots. Yeah.
Yeah, well you... You took some classes at one point in time in German and French, so...
Well, there's that too, but like Spanish or even Italian, you can kind of figure out, you know, but Dutch, you can't even do that. You can see the roots of some words in say, Italian or whatever, but you can't do that in Dutch. It's just very...
Yeah,
it's just gibberish.
And with Windows 98 NL,
if you
look at my computer and you click on the, you right-click on the hard drive, It's not a pie diagram. It's a big wheel of cheese. No, I'm just kidding.
Okay.
Gouda. It's Gouda. Yeah, but, and then the worst part was it started talking to me. It started actually vocalizing things. I had no idea. No idea. I go to print something, and it's like, Varnda Iskimol, you know, yakety schmackety. Just like going on and on. I have no idea what she said to me.
Okay. Well, I mean, I understand what you're saying. German, you definitely can make out a thing here and a thing there.
And I mean, I don't know
because it's at least in the same linguistic family as English,
right? So is like say Italian has a lot of very similar things too. Like you know, you go to get like pizza with mushrooms on it, and it's like fungi. You know,
fungi,
you can
yes.
figure that out.
Yeah.
Fungus, you know, but not everything. Not everything is
yes, I'll have a
Dutch
pizza with fungus.
Well, it is.
Yes, I know it is. I know it is, but it sounds weird.
You see them scraping something off their toes in the background.
Hold on, let me get that fungus for you.
Okay. Let's see here. All right, I'm going to throw out one more item here, and then we're probably going to have to break it down for the evening and get ready for... get ready for the hockey game coming up at 7:00. And let's see here. This item is about one of our favorite topics, or at least one that we hit quite frequently in the past several months.
The unpronounceable fella.
Yes, that's the one,
Mr. Unpronounceable. We actually
now how did Christina say that was pronounced?
We did actually. We've been pronouncing it kind of correctly. But, of course, there may or may not be an accent over the O, and since we're getting it translated into English, we'll never know, because it's certainly not written correctly. But it could be Sklerov, or Sklerov, or something like that. It depends on where you put the accent, if it's Sklerov or Sklerov.
Well, actually,
like
we should ask
Alex.
No, I actually asked Christina, who has been to Russia. She's not Russian herself, but she's
yes,
been to Russia,
Alex
and
is.
She majored in Russia.
Alex was born in Russia. So.
I know Alex was born in Russia, but she,
no one
knows, she
no,
translated
none of our listeners
it.
Know who Alex is.
No.
She did translate it into the Cyrillic, and then she tried to pronounce it, and she couldn't pronounce it either, and she was a Russian major.
Okay. Well, let's see here. The defense lawyer for a Moscow company accused of violating U.S. copyright law asked a judge on Monday to dismiss charges against the company, arguing that the borderless internet is outside the jurisdiction of the United States law. It's a novel argument, said Joseph Burton of the San Francisco firm of Duane Morris, who is representing Elcomsoft. The software company faces charges of violating the Digital Millennium Copyright Act by selling and conspiring to sell a program that lets people use Adobe Systems ebook reader copy and print digital books, transfer them to other computers, and have them read aloud by the computer. Oh, what a horrible thing to do. Have the computer read a book out loud to you.
Couldn't you do that anyway? Because you can download stuff from Adobe, and all you've got to do is cut and paste into like one of those... Like that program that you have there, Phil.
Text aloud. Yeah, but the
it wouldn't let you cut and paste.
It doesn't?
No.
How do they expect you to use the thing?
You're supposed to read it.
But what if you're visually impaired and you need it read to you?
Ah, well, unfortunately, the response I have
still,
to that question...
They're still interested in gouging the disabled community, huh?
Unfortunately, the response I have to that question is not something that I am permitted to say at this microphone.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
We'll just leave it at that. At any rate, the Moscow firm faces $2.25 million in fines if convicted of violating the 2-year-old copyright law, which, by the way, is 2 years old, too old, I think, which bars the creation of distribution or of technology that can be used to circumvent copyright protections. Prior cases have challenged U.S. jurisdiction based on the location of web servers, Burton said. Those cases have argued that if the servers that host allegedly illegal activities such as pornography or gambling are physically located outside the country, that they are not subject to U.S. law. You know what? They have got a point there, because...
Well, what happens if, say, an American puts some illegal content on a foreign server? Could he get in trouble?
Can you prove that the American did this?
All right. Say you can.
So let's say that you can. Then I would have to say most likely. Because
if
the fact that it would... If you can prove that an American was the one that put the content up, I would say probably because of the fact that the putting up of the content was done on American soil.
Okay, but if you went overseas, put it on a foreign server, and then came back to the United States, then...
Yeah, well, there you're running into an area where it's should be legal, but they'd probably find a way to come after you anyway. I mean, we've used the analogy before. I think you were the one that came up with this one. Basically, what in Skliarov's case, or Skliarov's, or Skliarov's, whichever.
Skliarov.
In his case, he had written a program whilst in his homeland for his employer, which is based in his homeland of Russia. And I guess it was posted on a web server belonging to the company, which also was in his homeland of Russia. And when he came to the United States, he was arrested for copyright infringement. And this is, I think you were the one that came up with the analogy, Phil, equivalent to somebody going to Canada, smoking a Cuban cigar, coming back without this Cuban cigar because you've smoked it, and getting arrested for having smoked a Cuban cigar.
Right.
It makes no sense at all. At any rate, go ahead.
What's the outcome, basically?
Well, the outcome is that the court case is still going. You know, this is just there's a hearing on these motions that's scheduled for April 1st. Oh, what a good day for it! So we'll have to keep you posted on this one.
Poor bastard.
Yeah, really.
Yeah,
but we are up against the clock here.
WRPI Troy.
You're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. Stay tuned for RPI
What's that
Hockey.
Station?
WRPI Troy.
WRPI Troy.
WRPI Troy.
WRPI Troy.
WRPI
Sydney,
Troy.
Come here. Come here. Sydney, come here.
WRPI Troy.
WRPI.
Say
Troy.
WRPI Troy. Say and WRPI Troy.
Just no, she's not going to say it. Well, that's
she's
quite
running.
All right. We'll run the official version now, and we will see you next week.